فوق الحتة وانعكا دور فرعك فتعقا فملوي انت وانعكا دور علي فتعقا فملوي انت وانعكا دور علي فتعقا
Welcome to the 92nd of the Cthulhu Podcasts. I'm FNH. As usual, we'll start with the next part of Through the Brazilian Wilderness. Then we'll have a musical number from 1926, and then on to part 10 of At the Mountains of Madness. Let's get started. Through the Brazilian Wilderness, part 52. Next day's march led us across a hilly country of good pasture land. The valleys were densely wooded, palms of several kinds being conspicuous among the other trees, and the brooks at the bottoms we crossed at fords or by the usual rude pole bridges. On the open pastures were occasionally trees, usually slender bacada palms with heads which the winds had dishevelled until they looked like mops. It was evidently a fine natural cattle country, and we soon began to see scores, perhaps hundreds of cattle belonging to the government ranch at Três Buriti, which we reached in the early afternoon. It is beautifully situated. The view round about is lovely, and certainly the land will prove healthy when settlements have been definitely established. Here we revelled in abundance of good fresh milk and eggs, and for dinner we had chicken canja and fat beef roasted on big wooden spits, and we even had watermelons. The latter were from seeds brought down by the American engineers who built the Madeira-Manaus Railroad, a work which stands honourably distinguished among the many great and useful works done in the development of the tropics of recent years. Amilcar's pack oxen, which were nearly worn out, had been left in these fertile pastures. Most of the fresh oxen which he took in their places were unbroken, and there was a perfect circus before they were packed and marched off in every direction, said the gleeful narrators. There were bucking oxen and loads strewed on the ground. This cattle ranch is managed by the colonel's uncle, his mother's brother, a hale old man of 70, white-haired, but as active and vigorous as ever, with a fine, kindly, gentle face. His name is Miguel Evangelista. He is a native of Mato Grosso, of practically pure Indian blood, and was dressed in the ordinary costume of the caballaco, hat, shirt, trousers, and no shoes or stockings. Within the last year, he has killed 3 jaguars, which had been living on the mules. As long as they could get mules, they did not at this station molest the cattle. It was with this uncle's father, Colonel Rondon's own grandfather, that Colonel Rondon, as an orphan, spent the first 7 years of his life. His father died before he was born, and his mother when he was only a year old. He lived on his grandfather's cattle ranch, some 50 miles from Cuiaba. Then he went to live in Cuiaba with a kinsman on his father's side, from whom he took the name Rondon. His own father's name was Da Silva. He studied in the Cuiaba government school, and at 16 was inscribed as one of the instructors. Then he went to Rio, served for a year in the army as an enlisted man in the ranks, and succeeded finally in getting into military school. After 5 years as pupil, he served 3 years as professor of mathematics in this school, and then as a lieutenant of engineers in the Brazilian army, he came back to his home in Mato Grosso and began his life work of exploring the wilderness. The next day we journeyed to the telegraph station at Bonifacio through alternate spells of glaring sunshine and heavy rain. On the way we stopped at an Aldeira village of Namicaras. We first met a couple of men going to hunt with bows and arrows longer than themselves, a rather comely young woman carrying on her back a wickerwork basket or creel supported by a forehead band and accompanied by a small child. At the village there were a number of men, women, and children. Although as completely naked as the others we had met, the members of this band were more ornamented with beads and wore earrings made from the inside of mussel shells or very big snail shells. They were more hairy than the ones we had so far met. The women, but not the men, completely removed the hair from their bodies and looked more, instead of less, indecent of a consequence. The chief, whose body was painted red with the juice of a fruit, had what could fairly be styled a moustache, an imperial. And one old man looked somewhat like a hairy Ainu, or perhaps even more like an Australian blackfellow. My companion told me that this probably represented an infusion of Negro blood, and possibly of mulatto blood, from runaway slaves of the old days, when some of the Mato Grosso mines were worked by slave labour. They also thought it possible that this infiltration of African Negroes might be responsible for the curious shape of the bigger huts, which are utterly unlike their flimsy ordinary shelters, and bore no resemblance in shape to those of the other Indian tribes of this region, whereas they were not unlike the ordinary beehive huts of the agricultural African Negroes. There were in this village several huts or shelters open at the sides, and two of the big huts. They were of closely woven thatch, circular in outline, with a domed roof, and two doors a couple of feet high opposite each other, with no other openings. There were 15 or 20 people to each hut. Inside there were implements and utensils, such as wicker baskets, some of them filled with pineapples, gourds, fire sticks, wooden knives, wooden mortars, and a board for grating mandioc, made of a thick slab of wood inset with sharp points of a harder wood. From the Brazilians, one or two of them had obtained blankets, and one a hammock, and they had also obtained knives which they sorely needed, for they were not even in the Stone Age. One woman shielded herself from the rain by holding a green palm branch down her back. Another had on her head what we at first thought to be a monkey skin headdress, but it was a little live black monkey. It stayed habitually with its head above her forehead, and its arms and legs spread so that it lay moulded to the shape of her head. But both woman and monkey showed some reluctance about having their photographs taken. Bonofacio consisted of several thatched one-room cabins, connected by a stockade which was extended to form an enclosure behind them. A number of tame parrots and parakeets of several different species scrambled over the roof and entered the houses. In the open pastures nearby were the curious extensive burrows of a gopher rat, which ate the roots of grass, not emerging to eat the grass but pulling it into the burrows by the roots. These burrows bore a close likeness to those of our pocket gophers. Miller found the animals difficult to trap. Finally, by the aid of Colonel Rondon, several Indians, and two or three of our men, he dug one out. From the central shaft several surface galleries radiated, running for many rods about a foot below the surface, with, at intervals, of half a dozen yards or so, mounds where the loose earth had been expelled. The central shaft ran straight down for about 8 feet, and then laterally for about 15 feet, to a kind of chamber. The animal dug hard to escape, but when taken and put on the surface of the ground, it moved slowly and awkwardly. It showed vicious courage. In looks it closely resembles our pocket gophers, but it had no pockets. This one was one of the most interesting small mammals that we secured. And as we leave the Brazilian wilderness behind, I can tell you that the music for this week is from 1926. It's by Nick Lucas and is simply called Always.
Everything went wrong, and the whole day long I'd feel so blue. For the longest while I'd forget to smile, then I met you. Now that my blue days have passed, now that I found you at last, I'll be loving you always, with a love that's true, always. When the things you plan need a helping hand, I will understand always, always. Days may not be fair, always. That's when I'll be there, always. Not for just a night, not and I'll be there always. Not for just an hour, not for just a day, not for just a year, but
And now on to the main feature. At the Mountains of Madness, Chapter 10. Many people will probably judge us as callous, as well as mad, for thinking about the northward tunnel and the abyss so soon after our sombre discovery. And I'm not prepared to say that we would have immediately revived such thoughts, but for a specific circumstance which broke in upon us and set up a whole new train of speculations. We had replaced the tarpaulin over poor Gedney, and were standing in a kind of mute bewilderment, when the sounds finally reached our consciousness. The first sounds we had heard since descending out of the open where the mountain wind whined faintly from its unearthly heights. Well known and mundane though they were, their presence in this remote world of death was more unexpected and unnerving than any grotesque or fabulous tones could possibly have been, since they gave a fresh upsetting to all our notions of cosmic harmony. Had it been some trace of that bizarre musical piping over a wide range which Lake's dissection report had led us to expect in those others, and which, indeed, our overwrought fancies had been reading into every wind howl we had heard since coming up from the camp of horror, it would have had a kind of hellish congruity with the eon-dead region around us. A voice from other epochs belongs in a graveyard of other epochs. As it was, however, the noise shattered all our profoundly seated adjustments, all our tacit acceptance of the inner Antarctic as a waste utterly and irrevocably void of every vestige of normal life. What we heard was not the fabulous note of any buried blasphemy of elder Earth whose supernatural toughness and age-denied polar sun had evoked a monstrous response. Instead, it was a thing so mockingly normal, and so unerringly familiarized by our sea days off Victoria Land and our camp days at McMurdo Sound, that we shuddered to think of it here, where such things ought not to be. To be brief, it was simply the raucous squawking of a penguin. The muffled sound floated from subglacial recesses nearly opposite to the corridor whence we had come, regions manifestly in the direction of that other tunnel to the vast abyss. The presence of a living water bird in such a direction, in a world whose surface was one of age-long and uniform lifelessness, could lead to only one conclusion. Hence our first thought was to verify the objective reality of the sound. It was indeed repeated, and seemed at times to come from more than one throat. Seeking its source, we entered an archway from which much debris had been cleared. Resuming our trailblazing with an added paper supply taken with curious repugnance from one of the tarpaulin bundles on the sledges, we left daylight behind. As the glaciated floor gave place to a litter of detritus, we plainly discerned some curious dragging tracks, and once Danforth found a distinct print of a sort whose description would be only too superfluous. The course indicated by the penguin cries was precisely what our map and compass prescribed as an approach to the more northerly tunnel mouth, and we were glad to find that a bridgeless thoroughfare on the ground and basement level seemed open. The tunnel, according to the chart, ought to start from the basement of a large pyramidal structure which we seemed vaguely to recall from our aerial survey as remarkably well preserved. Along our path, the single torch showed a customary profusion of carvings, but we did not pause to examine any of these. Suddenly, a bulky white shape loomed up ahead of us, and we flashed on the second torch. It is odd how wholly this new quest had turned our minds from earlier fears of what might lurk near. Those other ones, having left their supplies in the great circular place, must have planned to return after their scouting trip toward or into the abyss. Yet we had now discarded all caution concerning them as completely as if they had never existed. This white, waddling thing was fully 6 feet high. Yet we seemed to realize at once that it was not one of those others. They were larger and dark, and according to the sculptures, their motion over land surfaces was a swift, assured matter despite the queerness of their seaborne tentacle equipment. but to say that the white thing did not profoundly frighten us would be vain. We were indeed clutched for an instant by primitive dread almost sharper than the worst of our reasoned fears regarding those others. Then came a flash of anticlimax as the white shape sidled into the lateral archway to our left to join two others of its kind, which had summoned it in raucous tones. For it was only a penguin, albeit a huge, unknown species larger than the greatest of the known king penguins, and monstrous in its combined albinism and virtual eyelessness. When we had followed the thing into the archway, and turned both our torches on the indifferent and unheeding group of three, we saw that they were all eyeless albinos of the same unknown and gigantic species. Their size reminded us of some of the archaic penguins depicted in the old one's sculptures, and it did not take long to conclude that they were descended from the same stock, undoubtedly surviving through a retreat to some warmer inner region whose perpetual blackness had destroyed their pigmentation and atrophied their eyes to mere useless slits. That their present habitat was the vast abyss we sought was not for a moment to be doubted, and this evidence of the gulf's continued warmth and habitability filled us with the most curious and subtly perturbing fancies. We wondered, too, what had caused these three birds to venture out of their usual domain. The state and silence of the great dead city made it clear that it had no time been an habitual seasonal rookery, whilst the manifest indifference of the trio to our presence made it seem odd that any passing party of those others should have startled them. Was it possible that these others had taken some aggressive action or tried to increase their meat supply? We doubted whether the pungent odour which the dogs had hated could cause an equal antipathy in these penguins, since their ancestors had obviously lived on excellent terms with the old ones, an amicable relationship which must have survived in the abyss below as long as any of the old ones remained. Regretting, in a flare-up of the old spirit of pure science, that we could not photograph these anomalous creatures, we shortly left them to their squawking and pushed on towards the abyss, whose openness was now so positively proved to us, and whose exact direction occasional penguin tracks made clear. Not long afterward, a steep descent in a long, low, doorless and peculiarly sculptureless corridor led us to believe that we were approaching the tunnel mouth at last. We had passed two more penguins, and heard others immediately ahead. Then the corridor ended in a prodigious open space which made us gasp involuntarily. A perfectly inverted hemisphere, obviously deep underground, fully 100 feet in diameter and 50 feet high, with low archways opening around all parts of the circumference but one, and that one yawning cavernously with a black, arched aperture which broke the symmetry of the vault to a height of nearly 15 feet. It was the entrance to the great abyss. In this vast hemisphere, whose concave roof was impressively though decadently carved to a likeness of the primordial celestial dome, a few albino penguins waddled, aliens there, but indifferent and unseeing. The black tunnel yawned indefinitely off at a steep descending grade, its aperture adorned with grotesquely chiselled jambs and lintel. From that cryptical mouth we fancied a current of slightly warmer air, and perhaps even a suspicion of vapour proceeded. And we wondered what living entities other than penguins, the limitless void below and the contiguous honeycombings of the land and the Titan mountains, might conceal from us. We wondered, too, whether the trace of the mountaintop smoke at first suspected by poor Lake, as well as the odd haze we had ourselves perceived around the rampart-crowned peak, might not be caused by the tortuous channeled rising of some vapour from the unfathomed regions of the Earth's core. Entering the tunnel, we saw that its outline was, at least at the start, about 15 feet each way, sides, floor, and arched roof composed of the usual megalithic masonry. The sides were sparsely decorated with cartouches of conventional design in a late decadent style, and all the construction and carving were marvellously well preserved. The floor was quite clear, except for a slight detritus being outgoing penguin tracks and the inward tracks of those others. The farther one advanced, the warmer it became, so that we were soon unbuttoning our heavy garments. We wondered whether there were any actually igneous manifestations below, and whether the waters of that sunless sea were hot. After a short distance, the masonry gave place to solid rock, though the tunnel kept the same proportions and presented the same aspect of carved regularity. Occasionally, its varying grade became so steep that grooves were cut into the floor. Several times we noted the mouths of small lateral galleries not recorded in our diagrams, none of them such as to complicate the problem of our return, and all of them welcome as possible refuges in case we met unwelcome entities on their way back from the abyss. The nameless scent of such things was very distinct. Doubtless it was suicidally foolish to venture into that tunnel under the known conditions. But the lure of the unplumbed is stronger in certain persons than most suspect. Indeed, it was just such a lure which brought us to this unearthly polar waste in the first place. We saw several penguins as we passed along, and speculated on the distance we would have to traverse. The carvings had led us to expect a steep downhill walk of about a mile to the abyss, but our previous wanderings had shown us that matters of scale were not wholly to be depended upon. After about a quarter of a mile, that nameless scent came greatly accentuated, and we kept very careful track of the various lateral openings we passed. There was no visible vapour as at the mouth, but this was doubtless due to the lack of contrasting cooler air. The temperature was rapidly ascending, and we were not surprised to come upon a careless heap of material shudderingly familiar to us. It was composed of furs and tent cloth taken from Lake's camp, and we did not pause to study the bizarre forms into which the fabrics had been slashed. Slightly beyond this point, we noticed a decided increase in the size and number of side galleries, and concluded that the densely honeycombed region beneath the higher foothills must now have been reached. The nameless scent was now curiously mixed with another and scarcely less offensive odour, of what nature we could not guess, though we thought of decaying organisms and perhaps unknown subterranean fungi. Then came a startling expansion of the tunnel for which the carvings had not prepared us, a broadening and rising to a lofty, natural-looking, elliptical cavern with a level floor, some 75 feet long and 50 broad, and with many immense side passages leading away into cryptical darkness. Though this cavern was natural in appearance, an inspection with both torches suggested it had been formed by the artificial destruction of several walls between adjacent honeycombings. The walls were rough, and the high, vaulted roof was thick with stalactites, but the solid rock floor had been smoothed off, and was free from all debris, detritus, or even dust to a positively abnormal extent. Except for the avenue through which we had come, this was true of all the floors of the great galleries opening off from it, and the singularity of the condition was such as to set us vainly puzzling. The curious new fetor which had supplemented the nameless scent was excessively pungent here, so much so that it destroyed all trace of the other. Something about this whole place, with its polished and almost glistening floor, struck us as vaguely baffling and horrible than any of the monstrous things we had previously encountered. The regularity of the passage immediately ahead, as well as the larger proportion of the penguin droppings there, prevented all confusion as to the right course amidst the plethora of equally great cave mouths. Nevertheless, we resolved to resume our paper trailblazing if any further complexity should develop, for dust tracks, of course, could no longer be expected. Upon resuming our direct progress, we cast a beam of torchlight over the tunnel walls, and stopped short in amazement at the supremely radical change which had come over the carvings in this part of the passage. We realized, of course, the great decadence of the old one's sculpture at the time of the tunnelling, and had indeed noticed the inferior workmanship of the arabesques in the stretches behind us. But now, in this deeper section beyond the cavern, there was a sudden difference, wholly transcending explanation, a difference in basic nature as well as in mere quality, and involving so profound and calamitous a degradation of skill that nothing in the hitherto observed rate of decline could have led one to expect it. This new degenerate work was coarse, bold, and wholly lacking in the delicacy of detail. It was countersunk with exaggerated depth in bands following the same general line as the sparse cartouches of the earlier sections, but the height of the reliefs did not reach the level of the general surface. Danforth had the idea that it was a second carving, a sort of Samoset, formed over the obliteration of a previous design. In nature it was wholly decorative and conventional, and consisted of crude spirals and angles roughly following the quintile mathematical tradition of the old ones, yet seemingly more like a parody than a perpetuation of that tradition. We could not get it out of our minds that some subtle and profoundly alien element had been added to the aesthetic feeling behind the technique, an alien element, Danforth guessed, that was responsible for the laborious substitution. It was like, yet disturbingly unlike, what we had come to recognize as the Old One's art, and I was persistently reminded of such hybrid things as the ungainly palmarine sculptures fashioned in the Roman manner. That others had recently noticed this belt of carving was hinted by the presence of a used flashlight battery on the floor in front of one of the most characteristic cartouches. Since we could not afford to spend any considerable time in study, we resumed our advance after a cursory look, though frequently casting beams over the walls to see if there had been any further decorative changes developed. Nothing of the sort was perceived, though the carvings were in places rather sparse because of the numerous mouths of smooth-floored lateral tunnels. We saw and heard fewer penguins, but thought we caught a vague suspicion of an infinitely distant chorus of them somewhere deep within the earth. The new and inexplicable odour was abominably strong, and we could detect scarcely a sign of that other nameless scent. Puffs of visible vapour ahead spoke of increasing contrasts in temperature, and the relative nearness of the sunless sea cliffs of the great abyss. Then, quite unexpectedly, we saw certain obstructions on the polished floor ahead. Obstructions which were quite definitely not penguins, and we turned on our second torch, after making sure that the objects were quite stationary. That's all the story for today. So that's it. Except for me to remind you that the opening music is by Victor Valdez from The Symbol Project. This file is released on an attribution, non-commercial, share-alike license. Until next time.
CthulhuPodcast.co.uk